Welcome to Plastics Unwrapped, a series supported by Dow, the materials science company. I'm your host, Maithri Seetharaman. In this podcast, we're on the hunt for solutions to some of the toughest challenges facing the plastics industry. We're going to try and have some seriously honest conversations with guests from across sectors and from across the world. So let's together figure out what it'll really take to save the future of our planet.
We need waste management to happen. It needs to start with collection. If the waste is not being collected and sorted, there is no circular economy, right? So this is a monumental ambition. We need to remind ourselves of that, that 2.7 billion people today lack access to basic waste management. I think we cannot forget that fact.
We were supposed to have figured out how to solve our global plastic waste problem last year. The Intergovernmental Negotiating Committee's fifth meeting, with a very fun acronym of INC5, was held in Busan, South Korea at the end of 2024. After it traveled the world for about 2 years, from Punta del Este, Paris, Nairobi, and Ottawa, finally landing up in Busan, where it all unfortunately ended without agreement and in deadlock over the inclusion of cuts to plastic production. Negotiators basically had to concede defeat and move the talks further into 2025 and acknowledged they failed to bridge some serious divisions over the very aims of the treaty. Jehan Bol, Dow's lead sustainability director, has had a front row seat in this journey towards a global plastic treaty. Jehan, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Maithri, for having me.
Paint us a picture, really, of what these negotiations looked like in Busan. A lot of cynics out there now looking at the results saying, hang on a minute, is this actually going to reduce plastic pollution or is this becoming just another symbolic effort?
I'm very optimistic that this agreement will happen. We need it to happen. As a business, as a citizen of the planet, we need this agreement to happen. So if we back up a little bit, in March 2022, countries agreed to negotiate an international legally binding instrument to end plastic pollution. And the resolution said they would address the full life cycle of plastics. And this is where the issue comes in, because countries understood this piece very differently. You know, how do you define plastic pollution? So you have a group of countries that are saying we need to tackle plastics, every aspect of the plastic life cycle. And others are saying, well, we need to fix the issue of waste management, because you have 2.7 billion people around the globe that don't even have basic access to waste management. And that's why you see plastic leaking into the environment, and we need to stop that. So when they sat out to negotiate, they agreed to do that in 5 sessions and 2 years. That is very, very ambitious in terms of a multilateral environmental agreement. So I'm not surprised, disappointed that they did not land an agreement, but really not surprising given the complexity, but also the divergence in views.
The divergence in views seems to echo of what's happening on a lot of these intergovernmental platforms when we're tackling environment. Were you at all surprised that there's now this rising criticism about how many business leaders, how many lobbyists were present in delegations or within the INC meeting, as compared to, say, for example, activists, scientists, academics, saying we're not getting our voices heard? Was that a contributing factor to not reaching an agreement?
Not really. I mean, there's 3,800 registered attendees, at least for the INC5 meeting in Busan. So that's a huge number of stakeholders. And of those, there's 600 observer entities. Industry is one of those. So as different entities, NGOs, et cetera. So I think everybody's represented. And I would say in Busan, it was a bit unusual compared to other INC meetings in that a lot of the sessions were closed to all observers, where governments sat down together and negotiated the text itself. So that was done outside the observer organizations.
When you look at the disagreement that happened, it was about the cuts to plastic production. That's where I think the negotiations really did break down. Can we find a middle ground going forward when it comes to the groups of countries that don't want to cut production and the countries that do think that that's the answer? Is there any compelling evidence that can be provided for either party to change their stance?
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, I would say supply and production was not the only sticking points. I would say the financial instrument, because we're going to need trillions over the next 20 years to close gaps in waste management, for example. And many countries don't want to sign something and not have the money to implement. And I think you see this repeated in other multilateral agreements. On supply itself, one of the things we're looking at as an industry is we serve all sectors that use plastics, whether that's the mobility sector. And you know, the electric cars, for example, will have a lot more plastics than combustion engines. You need to add weight, the increased battery weight. You're going to need a lot more plastics for construction and infrastructure. A lot of people will be living in future in cities. A lot of those buildings still need to be built. So as you look across all those sectors that we serve as a plastics industry, there is an opportunity to be thinking, what is the problem we are trying to tackle? We're trying to tackle the plastic that's leaking. So instead of going, to me, I liken a production cap as a butcher's hacking knife. Well, you really need a surgical precision, right, in tackling the issue. The issue is what's leaking into the environment. What typically leaks tends to be the short-lived types of plastic applications. You have fishing gear, all of these things, right? So there's a way to tackle the issue with surgical precision. That really means, from our perspective, creating the demand drivers for more circular plastics. Because what we production follows demand, right? We produce to the demand that's there. If the demand is there for recyclable plastics, the demand is there for plastics with recycled content or plastics that's refillable or reusable, that's exactly what we will produce, right? So there's a very neat way of addressing the issue, which really also meets what many of the high ambition coalition countries are calling for, but you do it with surgical precision. Otherwise, you don't, you know, you get unintended consequences that you haven't set out to do, because when you constrain the production of plastic and you constrain the supply, it creates a lot of issues for many, many sectors that depend on plastics.
So how are we going to sell this? How do we find that middle ground, Jihan?
I think the financial instrument is a very critical piece to fix, because we're talking about probably $1 trillion a year that's going to be needed between now and 2040 if you really want to cut down 80% of the additional leakage into the environment. And there's no question that waste management infrastructure needs improvement in many parts of the world, even in some developed countries. But we also need to tackle those the waste management infrastructure that's completely lacking in certain countries in the global south. And, you know, we have great examples of how it can be done. We were in Korea. Busan is a beautiful city. But what really struck me is there is no litter anywhere. We, the visitors, probably caused some litter. We also probably didn't know how they recycle in different bins and how they separate the different recyclables. But I will tell you, I've also seen a lot of uses of plastic. They use a lot of plastic. And I think it's for hygienic reason. Like the PET bottle, for example, had an extra layer of plastic on top of the cap. And that's for hygiene reason. Every fruit was individually wrapped in plastic. So it is possible to consume. It is possible to consume and create a circular economy, and it's possible to educate society, because you need the consumer to contribute to a circular system. So I think countries like Korea, many, many countries that have developed systems, can teach others, because we need to help build that capacity. We need not only to give the financial instrument to those countries, we need to show them how it's done as well and help them educate their societies. So there's a lot of room here. This, to me, this is a huge ambition. A lot of countries are saying you only get ambition if you regulate every aspect of plastic. I would argue back that fixing the waste management infrastructure, that is a huge, huge ambition. And it's needed to solve the challenge of plastic in the environment.
It's a huge challenge that a lot of people in waste management will turn around and say, hang on a minute, we'd love to do this, but we have a problem. There's a lot of chemicals in plastics that stops us from being able to recycle or causes issues within the recycling system. And not every recycling system, as you've kind of pointed out, is created equal around the world. This plastics additives database that you guys are talking about now, how is that going to change the conversation?
Before I jump into the plastic additives database, I just want to say design plays a really key role in ensuring that you have a circular economy. So it is a critical element. For example, PET bottles, a lot of producers don't add any more colorants to it to make sure that more PET could be recycled directly into PET for bottles. So there are design standards, and they will need to play a critical role in ensuring that we design products in a certain way. There's a lot of design standards around the world that are sector-specific, application-specific, and we're really asking that countries promote the use of those design standards. So that is a key piece. Coming back to the additives database, I'm very proud that as an industry, we have been very constructive because we are hearing the concerns about transparency on what additives are in plastics. We've heard the narrative of 16,000 chemicals associated with plastic production and that some don't have safety information. So what we set out to do, this is a multi-million, multi-year project, is to really survey the industry about what additives are used in plastics. And we're creating a one-stop shop in that database to show what's actually in commerce, because a lot of those numbers don't add up. We don't think there's that many that are used in plastics today. So we're putting the information in a one-stop shop in that database. We're linking in what uses those additives go into, categories of uses. So you can actually query the database to what's used in polyethylene or PET, what's used in a particular product category. We're using the OECD product categories, but also we're linking in the government assessments that have been done of those specific chemicals and plastics. And really, we're providing access to anybody. This is really for governments to enable them to really query the database and understand what do they need to be concerned about.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, Jan, because about, 100 countries in Busan were very supportive of phasing out certain chemicals and single-use plastic and all of that. That was something that found more agreement, I think, than those cuts in production that we were talking about earlier. So if that is the one agreement we get, it in the next meeting or in the treaty about regulating the chemicals in plastics. Even just on that, how does that impact producers like you, smaller producers, bigger producers around the world? How does that affect business?
So I want to backtrack a little bit. Just in Bonn in September 2023, there was a Bonn declaration, and it was about the Global Framework on Chemicals, the GFC. And the GFC is working to make sure chemicals are managed safely in all their uses. And what the GFC, even though it's a voluntary tool, it is asking countries that don't have chemical management programs today to actually implement chemicals management, comprehensive chemicals management. This means assessing a chemical's use in many, many applications, because sometimes a chemical used in plastic is also used in personal care. It's used in paints, in coatings, in paper packaging, in many other applications. So from our perspective as the chemical industry, we're highly regulated. We want to see chemicals regulated, but in the right instrument. We don't want to create another regulation within a regulation. We want chemicals to be regulated under chemical management for all their uses, because otherwise you're creating unintended consequences. Let's say you regulate a chemical in a plastic, but it's also used in paper. And now you've regulated in plastic, people are not using that plastic, they're using the paper, but it's used there too. So the logic is you need to ensure all chemicals are comprehensively assessed across all their uses. We would rather see capacity building for countries. Brazil just introduced, for example, a chemical management system. We've been pushing for them to do that for a number of years. We're working with many countries in Southeast Asia as well to create comprehensive chemical management programs. For us, that is the answer to safe chemicals management, not layering in more regulations within a really already complex treaty.
But there's innovation happening within the company as well. I think Dow's own CEO, Jim Fitterling, I think last year was talking about a very science-based approach, looking at simplifying polymers so that they are recyclable. So let me put on my devil's advocate hat. If you have a chemical that is completely safe in an X use, but stops you from recycling plastic in another use, how do you balance that? Because if you allow it to be used in a country for whatever purpose, but it stops the recyclability of plastic, that would be a problem, wouldn't it, Jihan?
That's where design standards come in. Remember the example I used of colorants used in PET? That's where design standards come in and say, okay, in a multi-layered packaging, you might not want to use this particular material because when it gets to a recycling facility, it's going to impede recycling. That's where design standards play a critical role. And we're advocating that countries promote those international design standards that are sector and application specific.
So I'm going to go back to Jim's comments in 2024. He also talked about, you know, the fact that the company is really focused on very well done peer-reviewed research, including aspects of the impact of things on health. One of the issues that Busan and all of the INC meetings have brought up is microplastics, for example. What kind of innovations and partnerships can happen with companies like yours, with industries like yours, to acknowledge the issue of microplastics and the solution to it?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we're doing, I will talk about a couple of things. In terms of what Dow produces, we produce plastic resin, and we have a program called Operation Clean Sweep, which is an industry-wide program that's really working to prevent pellet loss. We're advocating for the treaty to include a standard like that in the treaty because we want that standard to be applied across the entire logistics and value chain of plastics. So that's one piece. But the bigger piece is waste management, because microplastics, macroplastics in the environment will break down to microplastics, right? So one of the things we need to do is to fix the waste management system so we stop the leakage. And one of the things we're doing in the industry, and it's something we started a few years back, is a multi-million research program on microplastics. We're really trying to understand microplastics are prevalent. They come from different sources. It's your tires on the road that are rubbing. It's the textiles that get washed and lead to fibers. It's the macroplastics that lead to microplastics. There's many things that are leading to that. We want to understand, should we be concerned? So we're embarking on a series of studies with different institutes, and you can actually go to the Global Partners for Plastic Circularity page. There's a progress page, and we've laid out all the studies that we're doing on microplastics, and we plan to continue that because it's important to understand what precautions we need to take in future.
Let's go back a little bit to the fossil fuel issue, because at Dow, you guys are looking at reducing scope one, scope two, looking at the energy security issues, because geopolitics tells us that the polycrisis is here to stay for a while. You're also currently working on the basis of self-regulation, voluntary targets. At some point, when you look at any kind of targets not being met in plastics, it does impact your carbon emission targets as well. What do businesses do to build a bridge between the countries that are convinced that a treaty is going to be harmful for an economy versus companies like yours that are investing so very heavily on clean energy to make sure that they can survive into the future? How do we build that bridge? Because companies voluntarily have already made the investments for years now.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we want to make sure is the Plastic Pollution Agreement does not try to regulate something that other instruments are trying to address, right? So when we talk about greenhouse gas emissions, we're thinking Paris Climate Agreement. In Europe, for example, I live in Switzerland, but in the EU, there's an emission trading scheme and the carbon budget goes down every year. And any installations that fall within that emission trading schemes need to reduce their emissions. So Dow has a huge, what we call path to zero. So we want to decarbonize, we want to grow at the same time, but we decarbonize and grow, right? So we have projects at different sites around the world to reduce our scope one and two emissions, right? This is where the clean energy piece comes in. This is where carbon capture comes in and storage in our sites. So we are doing what we need to do, because also there's demand from our value chain for low carbon products. So there's demand for circular products and there's demand for low carbon products. And we're trying to meet that demand. So we're producing to meet that demand. So in terms of clean energy, we're one of the biggest purchases of wind energy in the US. A lot of our sites in Europe have renewable energy contracts. We're also working on small modular nuclear reactor developments. Because don't forget, you know, as we grow and population grows, as AI continues to grow, you're going to need a lot more energy. Data centers need a lot of energy, right? So you're seeing a lot of tech company is trying to also secure sources of low carbon energy as well. So that demand is going to continue to grow, and we're doing what we can because we also have a carbon neutrality goal by 2050. So what I would really say again about the plastic agreement, it doesn't need to replicate what's being done under instruments, right? Chemicals should be regulated under chemicals management in all uses. Climate emissions need to be regulated under climate type regulations, right? So we don't need to replicate all of that in the instrument. And one of the things I think people often forget is that plastic has really changed our supply chains. It's really removed a lot of carbon emissions that would have happened if we did not move to plastics. So people focus a lot on the emissions in the production phase of plastic, forgetting the savings of emissions over the life cycle of that plastic use. So I think we need to bring back, you know, this data. It's very important data because I dread to think what, you know, unintended consequences that will happen if we again use a butcher's hacking knife versus using surgical precision, right? So we come back to that point.
I think the surgical precision bit is quite important, especially since we are planning other meetings in 2025. And frankly, 2 years, I agree with you, is quite ambitious considering 29 years later, we're still in no agreement about the overall climate at the COPs. Inga Andersen, who is the UN Environment Chief at the end of Busan, I'm going to quote her here, Jihan. She basically said, I do believe there's no point in meeting unless we see a pathway from Busan to the treaty text being gaveled. What does a treaty text ideally look like that is sensible with those precision tools that we're talking about to you and to Dow? Or do you think it's going to be more stalled progress and we go down the COP way, many, many years of talking and talking and talking?
Gosh, I hope not. I do hope we have a treaty at INC 5.2. You know, you recalled that quote, if all you can do is crawl, start crawling. I think it's important to get started. For me, getting started meaning tackling waste management, right? This is a huge ambition, right? People keep calling this a low ambition. This is not a low ambition. Think about all the money that's going to be needed, all the work that needs to happen, the coordination. For us as a business, we need waste management to happen. It needs to start with collection. If the waste is not being collected and sorted, there is no circular economy, right? So this is a monumental ambition. We need to remind ourselves of that 2.7 billion people today lack access to basic waste management. I think we cannot forget that fact. We have to acknowledge there are other concerns, right, from different stakeholders. We cannot put those aside either, but we need to put first things first, right? And we need to get started. And that's what I hope 5.2 will help us achieve.
On that note, Jihan Ball, fingers crossed, 5.2 and beyond. We might solve the problem after all. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Maitri.